Greetings, race community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Mike Andreasen, who serves as Vice Chancellor for Development at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Welcome, Mike.
Great to be with you.
Well, I've been looking forward to this conversation. Our paths crossed early in my entrepreneurial journey at Evertrue, having the opportunity to work with your team at the University of Oregon and getting to visit, which was truly one of just an amazing highlight on when I think about trips I've been able to take in this role. But today is not about me, it is about you. And so I want to learn more about your advancement leadership journey and share that with our RAISE community. So tell me a little bit more, take me back to junior year of high school. Who was that Mike? Where was he? And what led you to UC Irvine?
So this is always a scary thing. If we record this and then my wife and daughter choose to watch it at some point in time, they may not like that guy. So we have to be a little careful. But I grew up in an academic home in Southern California. Went to a Christian college, a Christian high school, a college prep high school. My dad actually was dean at the affiliated university. And so I grew up around the academy, and I grew up with faculty and for dinner at the home. And you know, my dad is, my folks were just visiting this weekend. He's been a big influence in my life to think about the role of education. And both my parents come from Europe, so we kind of had a global education-minded environment. And so the guy in high school thought he was going to follow the academic journey of his parents or his father. And I ultimately decided that wasn't my journey, that I wanted to kind of break out and go into the public higher education sector. I was really interested in going to a large public university and seeing what that's about, having grown up in a smaller environment. And in that journey at Irvine, by just necessity, you know, saw the flyer, do you want to be a telephone caller and make a little money? And coming out of a, you know, a middle income family, I thought, well, that'll be a good way to help cover my expenses of living in Newport Beach. And so I became a student caller. And freshman year, and really wasn't that good. That's the story that most people don't.
How do you know you weren't that good? I mean, give me like the reflections, the metrics, back up your mediocrity as a first year student caller.
So this is the story I've told on occasion, but not too widely because it might hurt my future career aspirations. You know, I took the job in January, and by spring break, the telephone director at the time called me in his office and said, "This is the copy of the LA Times. It has a classified section in the back. You probably ought to read it." That's how I knew I wasn't doing very well. And, you know, I had been pretty successful, frankly, in things I had done in my life. It was really the first big setback, and it was jarring. And I really didn't know what to do.
So here's my question, because it's one thing to get feedback. It's another if you were completely if you were oblivious to the feedback. So were you feeling confident, or did you kind of know you weren't really getting it done? Did you expect to have that conversation? Yeah. That is one way to deliver tough feedback.
Yeah, it's you know, lessons learned not to do. You know, I think candidly, as you know, and certainly back in the 80s, way before we used computers, you had the calling cards and the phones. We were calling non-donors, and pledges were hard to come by. So I didn't really know. I mean, you had goals and expectations, and I didn't really know why it wasn't working. I knew it wasn't quite right, but you know, lots of us were sort of struggling. People would quit more than get fired. It was pretty rare to get fired. And so it was a blow. The actual it's not working conversation was unexpected. Maybe the deeper feeling like it wasn't going well. But there is an amazing lesson that I've shared on, again, privately on occasion with a few folks. The first lesson was there was a student manager who said to me, you know, it's spring break, shifts are pretty light next week, why don't you come in and we'll have you make some calls and you can kind of transition a bit. So there was an act of grace. I'm not sure why she did it, but she just, I think, probably saw the Times, the classified section, and probably knew that wasn't the right way to do it. And so that next Sunday, I went in for my afternoon shift, and I wouldn't say that I was disrespectful, but I threw the script out. I just said, you know, I'm here for the hours, don't care. I'm just going to talk to people about why they ought to give to Irvine. And I ran a 7% pledge rate that week and had more gifts in 4 days than I had had, you know, in the previous 3 months. And then the telephone manager came back and said, we're going to confirm all those pledges. We don't really those are legit. And I said, well, you call them all. And they all checked out. And he said, all right, I'll tell you what, if you're willing to call non-donors for the rest of the spring quarter and do whatever it is you're doing, you don't have to follow the script, just do you. I'm okay with that if you're okay with that. And that's how I ultimately got unfired. And it was such a powerful lesson that when we think about philanthropy at whatever level, authenticity is the premium. It is the magic sauce, whether it's a $100 million gift or that first $100 gift. And so I think about that more often than maybe I'd like people to know, but it was a reminder that if it's not really who you are and what you represent, donors aren't going to buy it. And so that was really how I got into fundraising. It was an incredibly powerful lesson very early on at, 18 or 19, however old I was at the time. And I'm grateful for it. And it's been a great career ever since.
Mike, I love this story. I'm going to slide off camera here if folks are catching this on video. I'm going to come back, but there's a reason. Because in the 15 minutes before we went live with this recording, I was squeezing in some outreach to my classmates for this Brown football fundraising day that we're doing next week. And so I should have just worn it for the recording because I was just wearing this 15 minutes ago, cranking out videos that I'm sending via thank you to my classmates. And I'm trying to be as authentic as I can be. And I hope that it means that the response rate gets a little bit better and the click-through rate gets a little bit better. And to be honest, it's way more fun doing that than following some generic script.
Absolutely right. And it's a great lesson for all of us at every level, maybe in life as well, but certainly in fundraising. And obviously this industry has grown so rapidly. It's one of the big fears that I have that we're chasing talent and we're chasing techniques and we're chasing, obviously technology is really important. And I just got to say, I thought I was sort of forward thinking about technology, but when you came to Oregon, those 7 years ago, 8 years ago, you really got me thinking differently about what are tools and techniques that can accelerate and enhance what we do. But it goes to the heart of what is our authentic story, our message, what are we trying to accomplish?
No, I think there's always been this trade-off between automation and personalization, right? You're either going like generic at scale, or you're doing an awesome experience for the very top of the giving pyramid. And there just wasn't a lot of in between. And that's where I do feel like a lot of the technology that's happening right now can let us elevate the personalization without necessarily sacrificing, and in some cases, actually improving our ability to scale. And it's never going to be quite the same. And by the way, if you're listening, what I was holding up was my football jersey. So I'd thrown on my football jersey earlier today to record some of these videos. But it's just, what are the little touches like that, that in a world of mass marketing and our inboxes being slammed and our text messages being co-opted by marketers, where you can sort of stand out with some real authenticity. And then how do you also bring that to, the buttoned up world of major gift fundraising? How do you kind of find room for that freestyling you were doing as a student caller as it relates to major gift outreach as well, for example?
No, that's exactly right. And I think we've all, I've been very fortunate to be part of some extraordinary gifts that we sometimes celebrate, but those gifts are really about those donors. I mean, the scale of the gifts about the donors, not about me, or about the pitch. It was the intersection between what the institution was trying to do and the belief and confidence in those donors that we could do it. And that's where that authentic conversation needs to happen. Because when you're asking someone to make that first $1,000 gift or that $100 million gift, it's based on the same principle that their philanthropy can in fact enhance and accelerate the institution's core mission. So do you know what that core mission is? Are you willing to actually put some benchmarks that you're going to go out and hit? Can you hold yourself accountable to that? And my experience has been, if you make those kinds of commitments, those internal sort of value-driven commitments, a donor will meet you where you're going, and they might even lift you to a bigger, aspirations you otherwise would have had. And that's how some of these large gifts that I've been a part of, it was really a shared understanding of what we're trying to do. And then that co-creation of, all right, could we really do it at scale or do it in some transformational way? And so we're going to try it at Carolina. They've just completed an incredible $5 billion campaign. I'm honored to have joined them at the end of that. And we're going to ask ourselves, how do you take that large base of true, genuine affection, love, and trust, and sort of elevate and inspire to even greater heights of philanthropy and being absolutely authentically true to who we are and what we're about. And that might even include a few things that we don't do or shouldn't do or can't do. And so that's the conversation we're engaging with as a leadership team. We have an incredible chancellor who is committed to this work as well. And so we'll see what the next campaign looks like, but we're onto that next elevation of activity.
I love it. Well, tell me more about this, one of the all-time great turnaround stories in the history of advancement leadership, which is you on the chopping block, turnaround, 7% pledge rate. Where does that story, sophomore year, junior year, like where did things go from there?
So called that spring, spring quarter and, you know, again, had found that magic sauce. Over the summer, I was asked to do some planning work. In those days, we really were really, you know, tied to the academic calendar. And so the summer was the time when you know, ordered things and planned for things. So I got involved in that. And then that fall began doing training and very quickly became a student supervisor. And leading up to my senior year, actually, 2 years later, I was running all the shifts. I was essentially working full time, much to the chagrin of my dad, who was saying, where's that academic journey? And so I was going to class as much as I could, but I was working full time for Irvine. And at that time, Irvine was just launching its first comprehensive campaign. And so I had some unique opportunities as a student to be a part of that and learn about how campaigns come to bear and what's the role for annual giving. And the most important part of that story, which usually gets told a lot more often than the first part, is turns out my wife was a caller. And while I did not give her the classified section, this sort of made it clear this was probably not her calling. So she decided to quit, quit-ish, if you want to call it that way. And then about 6 months later, we went on our first date and magic was made and we've been married 31 years. And so, met Marie at Irvine. She understands this industry because she started as a student. She's been along that journey with me the whole time. But that really opened up the opportunity for a full-time career. And so I graduated on a June and 1990. And the next Monday, I became the head of the annual fund, was promoted and then quickly recruited to UC Santa Barbara. In 92, after we got married, Marie was a couple of years behind me, so we wanted her to finish up and really built the first major gift team at Santa Barbara and had wonderful mentors. I mean, just really incredible fundraisers who took the time and energy to build my career. And you know how much you want to get in all this, but ultimately spent 11 years at UCSB. I did have a prodigal year, 4 years and 7 years. The prodigal year in 96, I worked at the American Film Institute. And there's a long, complicated story of how we got to LA, but that was an awful lot of fun. We were focusing our fundraising on historic preservation of the great American films. So I was working in New York and Washington and with all the studios and just good old fashioned trying to raise money to preserve films. And, you know, all the red carpet premieres and Hollywood and we had a blast, but it wasn't that long. I'd say 6-7 months. When I missed higher ed, I knew that was really where I needed to be, whether it's that familial connection from growing up in a dean's home or whether those mentors. And so it was the one time in my career where after, 11 months, I realized I was in the wrong spot. And so UCSB was about to hire the head of their regional major gift team and begin planning for their first campaign. And so they called up and said, we're about to hire someone, but we think you probably would have wanted this job if you'd stayed, any chance you'd come back. And so we moved back to Santa Barbara, spent 7 years there and launched the first campaign. I was campaign director at the end and worked for the chancellor directly. That then led to a tremendous opportunity, maybe the most defining opportunity of my later professional career, to join the team at Michigan at the business school And I sometimes famously say before it became Ross and after it became Ross, and really had a chance to work with the dean, who was incredible.
But before you dive into that, you are, I mean, at this point, California kid.
And whole life.
Ron, I mean, Irvine, Santa Barbara, truly one of the most amazing places that I've visited. And Michigan is not necessarily the most logical next step that one would imagine. Not an easy step, I can't imagine. But tell me more about what inspired you to make that leap. Pretty big
one. We two California kids, seven winners in Michigan, and the car never got in the ditch. That was our. There was actually an office pool, and someone collected handsomely that I never got in the ditch. You know, it's a great institution, and it has a tremendous history. Jerry May was the vice president, and we knew him as a real legend in our field. But what really inspired me was the dean, Robert Dolan. Bob Dolan had just come from Harvard Business School. He was a senior associate dean. I think he's still the most successful case writer in HBS's history. And just, a genuine human being. There's no reason to leave HBS, right? Why would you do that unless you had a vision? And what I learned from Bob was that really big, audacious ideas generate really big, audacious gifts. And again, we get really caught up in our industry around, you know, all the cultivation steps and, you know, the $1,000 gift leads to the $10,000 to all of that. And what Bob really said is, no, we're going to do something that is so unique in the business school higher ed space that it's deserving of a major, major investment. And that then led to an incredible partnership with Stephen Ross, a related group. Stephen's one of the great philanthropists in the country. And he decided to make the lead gift for the business school campaign, a $100 million gift, the largest at the time for the University of Michigan or for any business school. And we were honored to name the school after him for that. And so being a part of that community, being a part of that leadership team, being a part of that donor experience really defined how I thought about philanthropy going forward. It's certainly what I brought to Oregon, and that led to some really wonderful gifts at Oregon as well. But again, it's we're here as stewards to relationships that last a lifetime, but it's that authentic vision and mission of what are we trying to do? And the more the audacious and bold and inspired idea, philanthropy comes right alongside and says, we want to join you in that work.
So tell me more about that to the extent you're able, because very few people listening have ever been or will ever be a part of a $100 million transformational naming type gift. There just aren't that many of them to go around. And so when you think about, I'm also fascinated though, because advancement is one of the only fields where there's this uncapped price point. That could have been a $40 million gift or 60 or 200 or 150. And you throw around these numbers, but there's a big difference between 50 million, 100 million and 150 million. Like, what is the circular process of even deciding, is it 100 or 400? How do you float a number? I mean, just like there's kind of this negotiation around this nebulous thing that is naming an institution. I mean, what lessons, if there are any generalizable lessons, and maybe it's just that there's nothing generalizable about it.
Well, I would say that everything we do should be based on business principles or thought, you know, value propositions of the institution. So it's not a random out of the hat process. I will also be careful to honor the confidentiality of some of those gifts, but it's been well discussed. And again, an incredible academic leader at an incredible institution. You know, Mary Sue Coleman was the president at the time and was really leading big conversations nationally, but an incredible, I use that word too much, but what Stephen Ross wanted to do was to really change and transform business education at his beloved Michigan. And so here's how.
Why did he want to do that? Why do you think he wanted to do that? What did he share publicly about?
So there's a couple things. One is he had been a donor. And actually, a couple of areas that he had early supported, we had sort of dropped the ball and hadn't quite done what we said we were going to do. There was some programmatic things. So we were trying to figure out how we can honor his previous commitments. And I showed up, you know, I'd literally been on the job about a month. And we were in a campaign. The university had set the campaign goal, you know, in that typical way, each school and college had been given a goal. And so the business school had been given one. And so I arrive in year two of a campaign, quiet phase of the campaign. And I was told, here's your number. You got to raise it. And so Dean Dolan said, we've got this amazing donor in New York. He's passionate. He cares. He's frustrated. I need to go see him. And the team has sort of suggested a number I ought to ask. And I said, okay. He said, well, do you agree with the number? I said, I don't know. I've been here literally 3 days. But here's what I think you should do. I think you ought to go on your own and don't take me. And he said, really? He said, you know, I'm told that, you know, deans can't go on donor calls on their own. I said, I want you to go on your own and I want you to talk about your big idea. And at that time, the Ross School of Business, or the Bishop's Business School, had developed an incredible curriculum on what we called action-based learning, that there was equal commitments to in-classroom experience and outside, you know, sort of experiential learning. And again, here's this amazing leader who had come from HBS and said, look, we know case method, we know the quant guys in Chicago, we know finance and Wharton. I mean, you could look at those top schools and say, what are their defining characteristics? What are your competitive advantages? At Michigan, we're going to teach you in the classroom and in the boardroom.
Yeah.
That's going to be our differentiation. And so I said, go talk to Steve Ross about this brilliant idea that you've got and tell him why you think it matters for Michigan. So off they went. And in that meeting, he said, well, Mr. Ross said, you're going to want me to make a gift. He said, yes, I need your help. And he said, well, do you have a number and in mind? And the dean said, no, I want you to buy into my vision first. And then we'll figure out the number. It was a second meeting, not there shortly thereafter. He said, well, you know, my uncle Max Fisher, who was one of the most instrumental mentors in my life, gave me that first loan when I got out of Michigan. You know, he named the Fisher School of Business at Ohio State. Wouldn't it be a legacy if I could do the same thing for my alma mater? And that would, it's not about my name so much, it's about following his leadership. He said, but I suspect it's going to be a little more than what Uncle Max had to do. And I think, Steve, to your point, was thinking, you know, a $50 million number would be sort of the right number. So we then began to think about it, and we did some due diligence. We looked at all the schools that had been named at that time. We looked at the scale and size and did a bunch of math. And we then went to New York and asked Mr. Ross for $100 million. A moment I'll never forget, January of 2004. And essentially he threw us out.
Okay.
And there's a lot of that meeting that I can't tell you, but you can imagine. Deeply loves Michigan, deeply committed to the institution. But when you're asked to do 2x of what you're thinking about it, you know, it takes a moment. So after some period of time, Mr. Ross reached out and said, all right, look, I'm still committed to the place. I'm committed to you. I love the vision of where you're headed. We needed to have a major new facility to match that new strategy of, you know, and it was really pre-technology in many ways. How do you build a building to support students around the world that are learning in companies, learning in industry? And so he said, could you write me up an economic rationale on why it should be that number, not a different number? I want to feel a bit better about the number. And then we knew we were getting a little closer. So I, another great lesson in my career, I began writing all weekend. You know, I pulled data and endowment versus capital, and this ranked school got this gift and we're ranked here and we ought to get that gift. And on Monday morning, Dean Dolan walked into my office and said, I wrote the letter and we're going to send it in an hour, but I want you to look at it first. And I said, oh, That's great. He said, I can't do it. I said, what do you mean you can't do it? He said, there's no economic rationale for 100. Why not make it 500 or make it 20? He said, the only reason to do this, and I've got the letter in my drawer, this is an incredible act of generosity. That's why you got to do it, Stephen. And we sent the letter. And for 4 days, we sat and we sweat and didn't sleep and drank coffee, drank other stuff. Mr. Ross called and said, I'm all in, let's do $100 million. And that's how that gift went down.
It's an amazing window in. Thank you for sharing. and such a reminder that there is really no other industry like this one.
Again, think about two individuals, remarkable in their own fields, one in the private sector, one in the educational sector, essentially coming to the conclusion that something extraordinary could happen. And then we celebrate the fundraising success, but think about the power of that gift and how many lives and how many students and how many industries are now benefited by Ross graduates. I sometimes worry we get caught in the arms race and who's got the biggest campaign. And one of the things I've said a bit about, and I know we're still at the Michigan time period, but one of the things I've said a lot at Carolina, you know, 200,000 donors contributed to our $5 billion campaign. And that's a really broad set of donors. And so I suspect the next campaign, they didn't hire me to try to raise less money. So we're going to continue to grow the role of philanthropy. But I pledge this, at Carolina, we're not chasing a number. We are convinced by the success of the past, the generosity of the past, that philanthropy can accelerate the time between discovery in the lab and treatment in the clinic, between understanding in the classroom and the library to changes in public policy, to the creation of new businesses. The problem I think that higher education is facing, this 400-year experiment starting across the pond and, you know, farther around the world, but the last couple hundred years in our country, the problem is we've gotten a bit complacent with how long it takes to actually do good.
Right.
And I think faculty members they want to do good. That's not research for research's sake. It's not teaching because you got nothing else better to do. You're trying to discover solutions to the great challenges of our time. And you're trying to educate and inspire citizens that carries on this great work. Well, donors are asking the same question. Well, why does it take 10 years between an idea and implementation? Could money, could philanthropy shorten that from 10 years to 5 years to 2 years? And so that's a grand statement to say, I know that, but the large gifts at Oregon, we had a couple of, as you know, we had a couple of $500 million gifts there and a $400 million gift before I left. Those large gifts also get a lot of attention, but they are specifically tied to time. Can you make a difference in a shorter amount of time? Oregon can build applied life sciences program over 20 years. You can do that. You hire your faculty, you recruit your students, you get tuition. I mean, you can build that machine. We've done it for hundreds of years, but could you do it in 7 years? Well, you could if someone believed enough to say, well, I'll put $1 billion on the table to do it. And that's what Oregon's doing right now, right? They're ramping up something. And you see the other places, you know, some of the big gifts around the country. I am convinced that all of philanthropy, but certainly transformational philanthropy, is really about time. It's about impact, not about scorecard and loyalty giving. And I gave 100,000 last time, so I ought to give 1 million this time. That's not the issue anymore, in my view.
Well, thank you for the window into the Ross experience. I mean, let's talk about Oregon quickly and some of the experiences that stand out. I recently hosted Michael Reza on the podcast, who was telling me all about the Ballmer Institute work and certainly other examples as well. But I think what you're highlighting is, and we've heard this from, you know, some of the, you know, really, I think most prolific fundraisers, fundraising leaders, is it's got to be about what problem are we solving? You know, what is the problem that we're solving? How can our university be the conduit to solve a specific problem that aligns with that donor's interests and passions? But it does start to feel, you know, further up the gift pyramid you get, more like that venture philanthropy mindset where, you know, this is like the return on impact needs to be somewhat quantified, even if certain aspects of it are just going to be an incredible act of generosity as well.
Yeah. So I would say, again, there's been some incredible gifts around the country, and we look to those institutions that do them on a regular basis. And again, I've been fortunate to be part of a few of these. I think the thing I would reflect on Oregon that was really palpable and powerful, and what I'm trying to bring here as we kind of build out our next major, you know, fundraising campaign, and this is maybe not as well understood or known, but in both cases, the two mega gifts from Mr. Knight for essentially bioengineering in the life sciences space, And the Balmer Institute, which is really around addressing an incredible need of children's behavioral health in real time, in where they're at, which is in schools, right? Both of those ideas followed a very similar ideation process, if you will. There were donors who were deeply loyal, had been giving for years, who were, you know, clearly committed to the institution and made very large gifts because of their capacity, but they were generous in spirit and loyalty to the institution. But both in 2016, 15, 16 for Knight and 2021 for Balmer, we put a small team of faculty together in a room, and I mean literally 90 minutes every week for 10 weeks. And we allowed them, we humbly asked them, and then we facilitated rigorous discussion about what problem we were trying to solve. Did we have the audacity to dream big enough given the capacity of what we believe the donors might support? And did we have the conviction and the commitment to execute? Because the last thing that Oregon or anyone should do, in my view, is take the big gift and say, well, you know, we'll try. No, we put very specific metrics about what we would try to accomplish in the first 3, 5, and 7 years. But that process, that 10 weeks, I cherish. It was messy. It was difficult. There was disagreement. There was rigor. And in both cases, when we ultimately got the gift, and there's lots of development fun, you know, legend storytelling about that. But in both cases, the donors turned to me privately and said, it was really your faculty. It was your faculty that, because we brought representatives of the groups to each ask. I mean, we had three faculty with Mr. Knight, two with the Balmer family, Connie and Steve. We brought in faculty who essentially had done zero asks in their first ask. One was $1 billion and one was $400 million. And that authenticity, and if you go back and watch the Balmer Institute video, and I'm not promoting that we do that, but if you're curious, don't listen to me and the president and all that other stuff. Listen to the faculty. You will hear the conviction of that 10-week rigor. They change from being just research faculty who are trying to discover things to faculty who believed that research could actually impact real people in real time. And when you get to that magic, the numbers get a lot bigger, because that impatient donor, that energy, that unbridled enthusiasm says, why can't we do more of this now? Well, we can. We just need a bigger gift to do that. And so I hope for the rest of my career, and we're doing some of this here, we call it strategic initiatives, and you've heard a bit about that. It's a kind of fundraising that lives sometimes between the schools and colleges, or it lives around a group of faculty who are trying to do something extraordinary and saying, well, what could $100 million do to take that work and bring it to the world more broadly, more quickly? Mm-hmm. And if we pick the right areas, and I think there are certain things at Carolina that we are uniquely qualified, we are uniquely committed and convicted to approach. And if we bring those to the world, I think every philanthropist, whether it's your first $100 or you're a billionaire, are going to say, Carolina's trying to do something that I care deeply about. If I can accelerate their impact in the world, why wouldn't I do that? And so that's how we're going to approach this next campaign. We're going to still talk to all of our schools and colleges and lift up those broad donors, those 200,000 loyal donors. But I believe donors are asking us a different question. There are a set of grand challenges that the world is facing. What is your institution, whether it's a community college or a number four public? What are you doing to tackle that challenge? And if you can convince us that you're committed to tackling that challenge, we're going to finance that work because we believe in it.
Mike, can I ask, I mean, given the success at the very top of the pyramid, if you will, do you have experiences where you've asked for too little?
Yeah.
Anything stand out of just, you know, calibrating around, again, it's such an open end.
We can, you know, you obviously you need to not, I, we used to say you can't offend if you ask too much. I don't. I think you probably can offend anybody, but more because you're not authentic, right? Then it's not a number problem. It's why are you asking for that number? And is it? But I think good research, obviously, and understanding and having partnerships like Evertrue to help us really be thoughtful and be educated going into what we're doing. I mean, that's really critical. And that's some of these tools and technologies and approaches have really sort of, in my mind, changed how we think about that question, which is what is the right number? But I think we've under-asked when we got scared by the number instead of actually thinking about the impact. And both of those big ones I just described, there was a moment where the faculty were talking about a much smaller number. And so we said, let's take a little more time. What if? And they looked at me and said, what are you talking about? No one has given at that level. I said, well, someone's got to be the first person to, you know, do this. And so I think I wouldn't be so worried about if you're asking too little or too little or too much. I would think more about, do you think you can actually deliver on that promise? And if you can, then I would be bold, I would be audacious, and I would be humbly confident, if that's the right way of thinking about it.
I love it. We have five core values at Evertrue: team first, humbly confident, action oriented, nimble, and kindly candid. That's our thank is what it spells, but humbly confident resonates. So I had to share that for our teams just to make sure that they knew I was on my toes.
That's exactly right.
So having that amazing run, you know, working with just obviously faculty, donors, having such memorable experiences, tell me about what inspired you to pursue the opportunity at Carolina. If you're comfortable sharing kind of what the sequence of events was, how the opportunity got on your radar, and then ultimately what gave you the conviction to say yes.
Yeah, you know, I'm incredibly grateful for the time at Oregon. I think the success that we had there probably put my name on someone's list. And so I got a call and said, you know, would you explore this? And it was not a particularly convenient time. I'd been traveling a ton, but carved out a short 45 minutes to speak to our chancellor, Kevin Guskowitz, who is a deeply, deeply mission-driven leader. I mean, he's a MacArthur Genius Award winner and a neuroscientist by training. But he says, and it hits sort of on day one, you know, Carolina, and I'll stand with it, we are the first public. I know there's another institution that debates that a bit, but we'll say we're the first public, but we are proudly public and maybe most public among publics. That is core to who he is. So what does that mean? And what that means to me is that we believe strongly, passionately, fully, that academic excellence, being the best of the best, recruiting among the very best, nothing against privates or other publics, we hold our own for the great thought leaders in the world. And we're equally committed to making that affordably accessible to our students. And that those two pillars are not in conflict. They sometimes feel like in conflict because it's a money problem, but they are actually complementary. So for me, beginning a conversation with a chancellor that says, this is what we are, what we stand for. And then to learn that what an incredible alumni community and a generous, the state of North Carolina, our legislature makes some of the largest investments in higher education than any of the states in the country, to come to a community that you know, believes in the power of education, from donors to legislators to the faculty. So I knew about the quality of the place. I began to learn about the deeply public mission of the place, the ecosystem that was really committed to our campus and, of course, the other campuses. And then to hear about a $5 billion campaign and what do you do next? That seemed like a pretty audacious and bold idea. And so I said, I'd love to learn more. And things went pretty quickly last fall. And I think the first conversation happened in middle of October. I was a candidate in early November. And we made the decision Thanksgiving weekend and then started in late January. We have a daughter who's now a senior in high school. She was in the middle of her junior year, and an incredible young woman who said, let's go. Let's take this leap of faith. And she's had a great time. Our son is a soon be graduate college student at Portland State University. And he said, I've got this. I know what I'm up against. So he's back in Oregon. And so we're blessed. We're inspired. We're daunted a bit. But I think this is a moment for our university to take sort of three decades of really strong traditional fundraising and to take that, stand on the foundation of those great leaders and say, okay, how does our university intentionally raise money that accelerates the time and scale of impact on society? And you know, we're doing the same thing everyone else is doing. You do a campaign feasibility and you got to decide quiet phases and public phases and all that technical stuff we do and really having some rigor to what we to how we approach fundraising. But we at Carolina will be committed to this notion of impact. That's what's going to drive everything we do, including a commitment to digital. You know, we have not quite begun the leap to what I would call a digital-minded mindset. And we look to thought leaders and industry partners like Evertrue to say, yeah, think about the untapped potential. And I remember something you said years ago that just stayed with me. And you mentioned it earlier in the podcast, you know, this tension between personalization and scale. And I think we're seeing tools that can help us do that in a really genuine way. But here's something else that you said, and I don't know if you remember, 8 years ago, you said there's going to come a day that your donor will expect personalization on this. They buy their airplane tickets, their concert tickets, they enroll kids. Everything happens on this. And why wouldn't their institution that they love so dearly behave in the same way? And so we've assumed that technology somehow diminishes personalization. It never occurred to us that our alumni, our donors, are actually enjoying that ride in the rest of their life. And so Carolina and other places, but I'll just speak about Carolina, we've got a lot of work ahead of us to think about the way that tools and technology can really expand what we do.
Well, we're over 40 minutes in and you are obviously deeply passionate about public higher education. And I love this conversation, but we're 45 minutes in, we're talking Oregon, we're talking Carolina, and you haven't said the words football or basketball. You've talked about impact, you've talked about public higher education and everything else that we've discussed. And so I love that because for people that don't know much more about the institution than what they might see on a Saturday, for example, there is so much more to it. But at the same time, part of what I imagine inspires that there is a symbiotic relationship between general excellence and success on the field, off the field, and how the donor population is feeling. And so how do you kind of navigate that?
You cannot disconnect. And anyway, and just look at my career, Michigan, Oregon, Carolina, athletics, the power of the student athlete, the draw of bringing alumni and donors together, none of what we have done at these institutions would be possible without incredibly successful athletic programs and the partnership that we have shared with each other. Just met for lunch today, John Montgomery, who heads up our Rams Club athletic fundraising, you know, world-class individual, seasoned fundraiser. And we spent lunch talking about how our commitment to raising money, both academically and for these incredible student athletes, these incredible programs, at a time, frankly, where, you know, collegiate athletics is under a lot of transition and pressure and tumult. But in spite of that, it is what ties people together. And I'm often asked by the faculty, you know, have you ever got an academic gift because the football team won a game? And I generally say, no, not usually. But a non-competitive athletic program makes it hard to have the conversation at all. That sense of pride in the institution opens the doors to conversation about athletics and academics and scholarships and community engagement. And so Yeah, it's not lost on me that I've been at places that are incredibly committed and successful and deeply rich history in athletics at our institutions.
It must frustrate you though, just given Michigan, Oregon, Carolina, there is so much negativity around higher education, public higher education. You know, and it drives me crazy because all day I'm just having conversations about life-changing transformational experiences, education as a bridge to opportunity, and I'm surrounded by it. I believe it. I've drunk the Kool-Aid. I'm making the Kool-Aid. But that is not the way most people feel, or maybe it is the way most people feel, but there's this really vocal, obviously group that is constantly questioning the value, and it's fine to question things, but I there are certain things that I'm seeing that you all are doing that I love, that I guess I'll say it's a little political because it is political. I saw this thing around the Tar Heel bus tour where you've got faculty and I think your chancellor that are almost like a politician doing the 99 county tour. They get on a bus and they drive around the state and they campaign. I mean, it's not called a campaign, but it feels a little bit like that. And I love it because it just must foster conversation and connection, not on social media or whatever headline gets the most clicks, but in small towns all over North Carolina. So I don't know, you haven't lived through that cycle yet, but it looks like it's about 2 weeks away. And I'm just curious about that intersection of kind of politics, mission, public higher education, and any lessons learned.
Yeah, it's a big topic. And I will certainly say after 8-9 months, I don't know enough to say something particularly intelligent there. Look, I've had a chance to meet with members of our Board of Governors, which is our system governance group. We have a very active local Board of Trustees, and I've spent a lot of time with them. I spent time with our faculty and our deans, and I've heard about some of this debate about politics. Here's what I know. In the state of North Carolina, the citizens of North Carolina care deeply about their universities. I mean, our applications continue to grow every year, and parents want their kids to come to our university and to some of our sister campuses too. I mean, it's a large system, as you know. Secondly, as I said, our chancellor, our leadership team is passionately committed to our public mission. That bus tour isn't just so people will get to know us and know we're doing good things. It's so that we get to know those communities that we are in service. We're talking a lot about how philanthropy in Chapel Hill can be felt and experienced in every county in the state. And how do we do that from the farthest western part out by Asheville and beyond all the way out to the coast? And I've probably been, 20 counties. I've spent a lot of time trying to get out. And I'm also outside the state too, because we've got Tar Heels around the world who care. But I guess I would say what I've experienced, obviously with some level of high, sometimes with high level emotion, are people who deeply care about the institution. And our new School of Civic Life and Leadership is a big discussion on campus, and people are wrangling with what does that mean? And the notion that we're going to bring students together to disagree and do so respectfully, to study this work and learn this work. Our new School of Data Science and Society is about not just having data proficiency and massive AI-driven computational capability. It's about, but what does it mean for society? And so, we look at all of our allied health, from dentistry to nursing to medical school, and we have a facility out in Asheville where we're actually taking residents and saying, do your residency in Western North Carolina, because there's a community that needs to be served. So I think what I hope is that we welcome the debate, that we embrace it. I think there is a question about costs. I think that many of us, and Carolina is right there, we're asking the question, it's no longer good enough just to graduate and graduate on time, but are you job ready? One of our emerging pillars for the next campaign, and I'm not making a public announcement here, but we're gonna be thinking about health and wellness, the whole human being, and workforce readiness. Are we generating graduates at Carolina that not only are ready to be nimble in jobs they don't even imagine yet, But are they going to create those jobs? Because we are seeing a massive evolution in technology and data and the knowledge economy that's being driven. So if a university can't boldly declare that workforce readiness, and not the debate about training versus educating, but to say, no, we have a responsibility to make sure our students are the best prepared for their careers in a changing world, then we shouldn't be in this business. And so that's, again, that very proudly public mission driven is, we're going to embrace these fundamentals going forward.
I love it, Mike. You got me fired up. I want to go back to college. Let me in.
Come on back. We're always looking. You got about a couple years of eligibility left, maybe? Who knows?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's going to be the ticket. But no, this is so fun. Thank you so much for your time today. And your energy is infectious. And I hope that your team feels that. And I got to give you an opportunity, just whether it's, you know, shout out to the team, or are you hiring for folks that want to learn more about what you all are building?
Absolutely. Let me just start by saying thank you. And thank you not only for the company that you built and the services that it provides. You've made us all better at what we do, but you've also been a thought leader. And I think there's that extra step beyond just saying, how do we build a great business? How do we help shape an industry? And so I'm just delighted to be with you. Yeah, we're hiring. Carolina is the place to be. I will say I oversee Central Development, which is called UDO, and University of Development. I got a great leadership team, and we're building out. We just hired some new folks. But the broader campus community, we call it the One Carolina, represents 26 units across campus. They are great teams with passion-driven leaders. And so we are in growth mode. We're gearing up for the next campaign. And anyone who's interested to learn more, I'd love to hear from you and appreciate the opportunity to represent Carolina.
Well, Mike is active on LinkedIn. I'd encourage you to follow him there. Reach out, let him know that you heard him on the Raise podcast. And Mike, it's really a pleasure to be able to reconnect. Thank you for being a part of this journey. And I look forward to continuing to dream big and really learn more about this idea of impact philanthropy and sort of moving beyond the loyalty giving, as you've said, into really solving problems across the giving pyramid. So with that, I'm just going to say thank you, Mike, and I'll sign off with today's guest, Mike Andreasen, Vice Chancellor for Development at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Take care, everybody. Thanks, Mike.
Go Heels.